on the next Snap Judgment, Omen. Storytelling with a beat right after the break. Stay tuned. Today's Snap Judgment podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one website platform. Now, Squarespace recently launched Squarespace 7. It's a completely redesigned interface that offers beautiful templates, integration with Google Apps and Getty Images, along with an incredible feature called Cover Pages. And all Squarespace sites feature responsive design, so your site looks great on any device. And every website comes with a free online store. Squarespace offers 24/7 live chat and email support. Go to squarespace.com for a free trial with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you sign up for Squarespace, make sure you go to squarespace.com, use the offer code SNAP, and get 10% off your first purchase. That's squarespace.com, use the code SNAP, Squarespace. Start here, go anywhere. Okay, so it's happened to me once. It crept like an instinct, a silent whisper, not to open a door. I am so grateful I did not open that door. Some things you can't unsee. Another time, a random whim to drive a different path home enabled me to give someone aid. These decisions, allowing an indefinable tug to pull you out of your routine, to break normalcy, can change everything. Today, on Snap Judgment, from PRX and NPR, we're going to dive deep. Snap Judgment proudly presents Omen. Amazing stories from real people deciding whether to follow the signs, whatever those signs may be. Please change your cell phone settings to do not disturb, because you're listening. Listen. To Snap Judgment. This is the Omen episode. So, in case you've got some kids in the back seat, know that our first storyteller, Jennifer Percy, was a young graduate student when she decided to explore a phenomena completely outside her realm of experience, PTSD and war veterans. As such, Jen walks through some very dark events and discretion is advised. Don't worry, we lighten the load later in the show, and some names have been changed in this piece. You'll soon understand why. Snap Judgment.
I was living in Iowa when one of the first suicides of the war happened, and the kid shot himself not far from where I was living. He locked himself in a truck and shot himself, and his mother was watching. And that suicide really jolted me, and I started reading more and more about what was being called a suicide epidemic at the time. I actually called the mother of the son and tried to talk to her about post-traumatic stress disorder, and she said, "You can't actually write about this or understand it until you've been all the way to the bottom of hell and crawled your way back." And there was really no way to respond to that. So I wanted to get to know someone who had come back from the war and what it was like to live in their mind. I wanted to write something experiential where I could recreate the movements and digressions and internal workings of what they were thinking and what's going on. So I met Caleb by luck, and I read an article in a small newspaper in Georgia about a soldier starting a company that would help suicidal veterans. And I thought I would go talk to this guy.
For a year, Jen had been reaching out to veterans to interview for her master's thesis, but nobody wanted to talk. So she emailed this guy, Caleb, one day. His response was quick, and in that first email told her more than she expected. When he was on tour in Afghanistan, six of his men died in a helicopter crash. It was a mission he was supposed to be on, but his superior pulled him out at the very last minute. He came home feeling guilty and convinced that he too should have died in that crash. Jen made hotel arrangements, gassed up her Jeep, and drove 13 hours south to Georgia to meet Caleb in person.
He had told me he was completely recovered. We were at a restaurant called Mi Casa, a Mexican restaurant. Very quickly, he started saying that the questions I was asking weren't really important. What was important was the fact that this big black thing that was coming into his room at night was not a result of a mental illness, was not due to the war necessarily in the way we understand it, but rather a demon that was following him. And what was important for me to know was that all the veterans committing suicide were actually being pursued by the same demon.
Sometimes Caleb called it the demon, the black thing, or the destroyer. He described it as an evil and shape-shifting force, intent on harming not just him, and not just veterans, but everyone.
It was a little bit shocking to kind of... And at the time, you know, I was a grad student. I'd never interviewed anyone before in this way. So I didn't have that much experience, you know, interviewing, let alone a special ops soldier with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Then Caleb went on to describe the cure he'd found for coping with these demons.
He mentioned an exorcism camp in rural Georgia in a town called Portal.
Caleb said he went to this exorcism camp, and the exorcism got rid of his demons. He'd never felt better. In fact, ever since, he'd been bringing other veterans to the exorcism camp to go through what the minister there calls deliverance, where they're effectively freed of all the demons that stalk them.
I initially wanted to just get out of there, actually. He scared me a little bit. I ended up calling my brother and just saying, yeah, this guy's a little weird, and he sees demons. And I was like, I think I'm going to go home. I wasn't sure how to make sense of, you know, a guy bringing veterans through exorcisms.
But her brother convinced her to keep an open mind. So Jen stuck with her project. And for the next 3 months, she met with Caleb regularly at Mi Casa, the Mexican restaurant. She would ask him questions about his past, about what led him to enlist. But pretty soon, Caleb started deflecting the spotlight to her, asking Jen questions about her own childhood, about what made her sad, what kept her up at night.
And suddenly he's like drawing pictures and making a chart sort of different things I've said. Like if I was scared of the dark, he would like make a little box and write that in it. And then if I was having trouble with my boyfriend at the time, he made a little box and did that. And so he's doing all this like strange work on napkins and stuff at the Mexican restaurant. And I kind of, you know, didn't really want to be part of the story. So I kept saying, okay, I really don't have any trauma like your trauma. I'm interested in what happened to you in Afghanistan. Can you focus on that?
It was frustrating for Jen, but at the same time, she was intrigued. In a way, Caleb was giving her what she wanted, an insight into his mind. And it was clear that the war had followed him home.
He started talking about, you know, the first time that the black thing came to visit him. The way he talked about it was terrifying. He was gesticulating, standing up. His eyes looked watery. He spoke in this really deep voice when he imitated the black thing. He said it was 6'5" and it was so tall it had to lean down to get through the door. And then it said it was going to kill him if he proceeded with whatever sort of journey he was on. He talked about his dead buddies, like their charred bodies coming into his room at night and how they would try to fight off the black thing. He would, for example, see 146, the number 146 everywhere. And 146 was the tail number of the Chinook that crashed in Afghanistan where all his friends died. The Chinook that he luckily stepped off of before it took off by circumstance. And he follows that number everywhere. He sees it on license plates. He got a lotto ticket with that number. And the more he talked about 146, the more I started to see 146 everywhere. It's still haunting to turn around one day and see 146 flashing at you on the clock, or to wake up at night and see it, or to find the pattern somewhere, you know, on a flight number or, you know. So in a way, I was sort of taking on the mindset of this guy. I was feeling a bit overwhelmed and trapped in it. And so, you know, there was definitely a point down the line where I start to get really, really annoyed at Caleb.
And why were you annoyed?
Because he would never stop accusing me of, like he did with everyone, of having a demon.
By now, Jen had been following Caleb around for a year, and she wanted to talk to other veterans and their families, see how their trauma manifested itself. She made plans to go to North Carolina and visit April, the sister of Brian, a veteran who was so haunted by the ghost of the Iraqi man he killed that he ultimately shot himself. But when Jen told Caleb about her trip,
he completely freaked out and said, if I talk to her, I'm pretty much screwed and the destroyer is going to come after me, that it would follow me home, that it would start to attack me. And it just sounded like crazy talk to me.
It was clear to Jen that other veterans were also experiencing haunting apparitions, and she wasn't going to let Caleb's superstitions, which frankly is what she considered them to be, stop her from doing her work. She went to North Carolina and stayed with April for a week. She slept on her couch and heard incredibly sad stories about her brother. April saw him talk to ghosts. She even bought him a trailer because he wanted somewhere to hide. His fears of impending doom were so contagious that April would also get scared.
She was sort of swearing at the government. She was talking about how people had been following her. She was clearly still in this wake of grief. So I felt like I was just sort of taking in as much of that as possible and carrying it with me. Her stories were so, because she wasn't the one who had been to war, were more poignant even than Caleb's because, you know, look at how it's the trauma is moving from one person to the other, how it affects whole families.
So when Jen walked away from April's house, she felt like she was still inside her world, and she couldn't shake that feeling off.
That night when I stayed in a hotel, I was terrified. I kept going outside. I was alone. And April's stories are swimming in my head. I wake up and I see this giant bat hanging on the wall. It's about the size of a man. And it just comes over and flies on top of me, sits on top of my chest, wraps its wings around me, sticks its claw in my neck, and just stays there all night. And then I wake up. I mean, at this point, it's just a nightmare. But the fact that, you know, it took place in the, like, there was a, the line between dream and reality was very small because the setting was the same. And so it was hard to sort of move away from that image of the bat. And then I get my car and I drive to Portal.
This is where the exorcisms are held. Portal is a small, desolate-looking town with one crumbly dirt road and one blinking streetlight. Usually, the exorcisms take place inside the minister's trailer, other times at an abandoned pizza hut down the street. Jen had been here a few times before. She'd gotten to know the minister and his followers. And now she wanted to talk to a woman who called herself the Son of Jesus.
She was living in a house full of women because all the men were gone at war. Some of them were soldiers, some of them were contractors. I told her about this nightmare I'd had. Yeah, I can tell it's like following you around. This isn't good. She tells me to sit down on the floor or sit down on a couch, and she surrounds me along with her daughter and some other people that were at the house, and they start giving me this impromptu exorcism. And they would touch me on the shoulder and start talking to Jesus and God, and, you know, they would have certain phrases from the Bible they would recite, and it was a lot of repetition. Their eyes are closed, they're whispering, and they're all saying, you know, what they think it is. They started asking it to leave and focusing on that, and that's when I sort of felt like I was falling into hysteria, almost as if my body were just sort of now sort of like a marionette, and they were just moving me, and just sort of felt a weight taken off my back and just sort of something being removed. What was strange about that moment is that I felt something physically come out of my body. And that moment, more than any moment, made me viscerally feel like I was inside of their world. I did feel better, and at the same time I felt worse because I felt like something had worked, which is not what I was looking for.
Had you ever imagined that you would have succumbed to that?
No, I guess I didn't imagine that that would happen at all. I imagined being completely resistant to anything they said. So when I got home, some weird stuff started happening after. I woke up in the middle of the night, and there was a bat circling over my head. A real bat, and it landed on me. I don't know if it bit me, but I went and got a rabies shot anyway, as you're supposed to do. There are quite a few bats in Iowa, but I had never seen one before this. The one time it happened, actually, when I thought maybe it was just the house, but then I was subletting from a friend for the summer. They were gone, and I was actually writing, and a bat comes into the office, starts circling my head. I killed the bat with a tennis racket. Another time I was at my brother's house and I woke up, they'd never had bats, woke up and there was a dead bat outside the window. I mean, it was just never leaving me alone, it felt like. And so I was going completely, I mean, it felt like I was going crazy. And other stuff was happening. I was waking up every night at 1:46 in the morning. I played the exorcism tape. I taped the entire deliverance session and played it in my kitchen, and the power went out right when I, you know, turned it on. I was in the state where the possibility of being followed around by your dead friends felt very real now. And that's a scary place to be, but also kind of where I wanted to end up. The problem is you don't really know how to get back out.
So Jen went deeper. She did a mental recall of everything Caleb told her about demons and how they operate, about how they move from one person to the next.
He calls me one day. I really think you should come to Missouri and talk to me. It was about a 4-hour drive from where I was, so I thought, okay. So it was sort of a release to just go back and say, why is this happening to me? Like, what have you done to me? Almost. You know, we go to a coffee shop. He sits me down. And it's kind of like, I think there's this giant bat following you around. And I was like, wait, I didn't tell you about the bat. What are you talking about? I hadn't really told him anything that was going on. How does he know about this bat? It was just this really creepy moment. He kind of got me riled up to the point where I was sort of in a panic. You know, and part of it was the setting and the way he talks. It was, we were outside, it was getting dark, power went out again. He was saying, oh, that means they're here. And then there'd be a long silence. Who's here? It's like the whole army is here. Army of who? The army of the demonic. What does that mean, after you? I see them coming in right now. They're surrounding us. And so it's just this invisible world that you don't see what he sees, and you can see him seeing it. And that was the moment where I realized, okay, this has got to be the end of it, because he's, you know, not on the same wavelength as I am at all anymore. And then I the next morning I drove home, and I didn't see him again. There's a moment in one of Hemingway's stories. There's a soldier, and he's in a trench. Because he's close to dying, he suddenly converts and prays to God. Once it's over, he's embarrassed and doesn't want to think about that anymore. So for me, I'm sort of constantly wavering between belief and unbelief, because I don't think there's ever going to be sort of an explanation that's suitable or comfortable. It's actually comforting to have that mystery there and alive. I was actually on a sort of vacation with my parents in Eastern Oregon. We had gone on a boat trip down the Snake River, and we found this like dead bat hanging from a fishing line. And that was the last bat I saw, actually.
There is so much more to Jennifer Percy's story. We'll have a link to her book, Demon Camp, about this very experience on our website, snapjudgment.org. And if you know someone suffering from PTSD, let's make sure they know they do not have to suffer alone. Go to woundedwarriorproject.org for more information. That story is produced by Nancy Lopez, with sound design by Pat Macedi Miller. When Snap Judgment returns, we're going to the birds. And someone can see the future. Do not miss this. When Snap Judgment, the Omen episode continues. Stay tuned. Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Because posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Post once and watch qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails, calls to the office. Just screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, Snap listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/snap. That's ZipRecruiter.com/snap. One more time. Try it for free. Go ahead. ZipRecruiter.com/snap.
Hey, thanks for listening to Snap. Give the Latino USA podcast from NPR a listen. Latino USA covers important issues impacting Latinos and other people of color. Reporting on how people live, struggle with, and celebrate difference, Latino USA chronicles how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, Omen. We don't know where they come from. We don't know, but if you look hard enough, there they are. Signs, portents, warnings, clues. And who can read the signs better than we can, Snappers? Who? Animals. They know stuff. And our next storyteller, she had a relationship with the animals, a relationship with birds. And that relationship went even deeper than she thought.
In Every year for my birthday, as long as I could remember, my grandfather bought me a white dove. It was actually a white homing pigeon, but I didn't know that as a child. I would sit with this dove all day, and I would marvel at it, and I would touch it. And then at dusk, my grandfather and I would go out to the yard, and we would release it together. It was a really magical moment for me as a child to kind of have that power of being able to release an animal. My grandfather had a coop in the backyard, and we both tended to it every morning. So we were always together. I was able to feel like I was part of his world, and his world was birds. He would always tell me about the bird market of Paris, where it has been for about 108 years. Apparently, the birds there are absolutely miraculous. They're of these incredible colors, and they sing these beautiful songs. I always thought as a child that I would get there someday. When I was 18 years old, a boyfriend bought me a lovebird for Valentine's Day. It was like this weird-looking, kind of ugly little squiggle of a thing, and it was sweeping, and I named it Bonk. Baby birds are a lot of work. I had to syringe feed Bonk every 4 hours. I had to care for it and keep it warm. They're ferocious and loving and smart and sweet. They bond for life. So they can either bond to another bird for life or they'll bond to you for life. My heart belongs to only you. I literally started spending every waking second with this bird. I had it tucked into my t-shirt. We went on dates. We went to college classes. Bonk would sit under my hair when I would go shopping. I literally had this bird with me all the time. And then I started breeding these lovebirds. I ended up with hundreds and hundreds of these lovebirds. My grandfather kept lovebirds from when I was a young child. So when I started raising birds and I had so many babies that I couldn't handle it anymore, I would give the babies to him. And then we both became really bonded in these lovebirds, and we would trade babies back and forth. And sometimes he would surprise me and he would just show up with this another beautiful lovebird. Imagine a house. There were bird cages and birds literally all over the house. I was a bird lady in the daytime, but I also went to college. I went out to nightclubs. I was a little beach bunny in Miami, running around in my bikini on the beach. I had plenty of boyfriends. I did not look the part of the weird bird lady. When I went to the bird clubs, it was all like grandmothers and moms and then me. I don't think of the birds as being other than me or being different from me. They're just other beings on the earth trying to survive, and I have stewardship over them. And I do the best I can for them to make their lives great. We lived in South Miami, and we heard that there was a hurricane coming.
Channel 4 News Team.
Good evening. This is a special expanded edition of the Channel 4 News Nightcast. A hurricane watch is now in effect for South Florida.
A hurricane with major life-threatening storm surge and damaging winds with significant...
I watched all the neighbors start preparing their homes by boarding up and buying supplies, and we weren't doing anything. As the hours went on, we started seeing where the hurricane was going to come, and it was headed right for us.
It looks like our luck has run out. Hurricane Andrew appears headed towards South Florida, and tonight we are under a hurricane watch.
The police came blaring with their horns, and they came door to door, and they said, you've got to get out of here. This is, you can be arrested if you're in a mandatory evacuation zone and you don't leave. I said, well, I'm not leaving. I'm not leaving my animals. And they said, no, you're leaving. You have to go. So I packed up 10 of my youngest birds and left the rest of the birds, locked the door, and hoped for the best. And I don't know why I left Bonk behind. I believed that nothing would happen. I got to my friend's house, and then sometime in the middle of the night, windows started just blasting out of the house. You hear the noise described as a freight train, and it does sound like that. The house was shaking. It sounded like bomb blasts outside. You could see the door in the attic jumping. The walls were shaking and the ceiling was moving and everything was swaying, and we were just huddled together in this closet. I was sure we weren't going to make it through this. Nobody spoke, and we were just looking into each other's eyes. All I could think about in that closet was my birds. Dawn broke, and I'd never seen anything like that. I didn't even know a scene like that was possible. It was something out of the end of the world. We walked out of the space where the door once was, and you couldn't see grass or asphalt or anything. The entire ground was covered with roof tiles. I absolutely needed to get home. I was anxious to the point of like almost having a breakdown because I had to get back to my birds. A guy next door noticed that I was very upset, and he came over and said, "I'll drive you to your house." He pulled out of his garage this Porsche 911 Targa, black on black. The shiny, beautiful Porsche against the backdrop of this ruin. Every street sign is down. All the landmarks you used to get home or to turn on a certain street are gone. We had to park about 10 blocks from my home because there were yachts in the street. And he climbed over these yachts and these mountains of seaweed with me, and we were just all bitten up by ants. I got closer to the house. There was no more door on the house. There were no more doors or windows, so it was easy to get in. There was a water line on the house at 7 feet. There were mountains of seaweed in the house. There were fish in the house and crabs and other people's furniture. I walked into the bird room, and there were just cages and shambles. Dead, drowned birds. There were cages that were just mangled, and they were all kind of crumpled on top of each other. And I tore through the cages, just pulling body after body of all of these dead lovebirds out of the cage. I was piling them up in the front of my shirt and weeping, and baby after baby of Bonk's babies were dead. Everybody, they all had names, and dozens were killed by the flood. And in that bird room, of the dozens of birds that were killed, there were 6 alive, and one of them was Bonk. She was screeching. Lovebirds don't screech. And she was clinging to the side of her cage and screeching, and I took her out, and I just snuggled her and cuddled her and kissed her. I just sat there amongst the dead birds and wept. I'm having an absolute breakdown because I've killed my birds. I walked out of that hurricane house a completely changed person. All I could think about was those beautiful, dead, wet birds still in their cages and what they must have experienced as that water just lapped in and drowned them. Those images ran over and over in my head. 24 hours a day. Like, I couldn't get rid of them. And I felt so guilty. These were things I was supposed to protect. I had this grief that pressed on me every minute of every day. The devastation, God, it's so hard to explain. I started taking in every bird that came to me through rescue, and there were dozens and dozens of birds. People were literally knocking on my door and leaving birds on the doorstep. Birds they didn't want, injured birds, birds they'd found. The bird hobby became a bird fury. The house really became just a lesson in pandemonium. Dozens of species. I ended up with a lot of birds. As my bird collecting escalated, my grandfather was declining, and he ended up passing away. That was beyond devastating for me because he was the closest person in my life. He was like my dearest confidant and friend. And I thought, you know, my grandfather and I were like a bonded pair of birds. I started noticing that alcohol could really kill a lot of the emotional pain. So I drank a lot. I started drinking every day. So I really didn't have any friends because, frankly, no one wants to be around somebody like that. I had this idea of doing this grand gesture that would make it all go away. Like, if I do this one thing, like, I'll be relieved of all of this emotion. So I thought, if I go to the Bird Market of Paris, which is a place that my grandfather told me about many, many times and said it was the best place in the world, and I buy a dove and I release it into the Paris sky, then I will be releasing all of this grief. It's a little irrational, but I go all in with the magical thinking. I think that's what magical thinking is about. You can't have doubts. You just have to be really, really confident about the magic. So I got the money and I exchanged my apartment for an apartment in Paris, and I got there. Sunday came when I was finally going to go to the bird market. I walked there very slowly. I had so much apprehension about it. And I turned the corner onto the bird market and I just heard this beautiful bird song. And I saw all of these beautiful birds. My grandfather was not exaggerating. It was beautiful. I walked slowly looking around because I knew this is a big deal. I have to buy the right kind of bird and I have to find the right place to let it go because my entire redemption of all of these things that happen, hang on this. So I studied this one guy, he was selling some pigeons, and I walked up to him and I said, I'd like to buy this pigeon. And he's kind of looked me up and down. He said, what are you gonna do with it? And I was kind of taken aback and I said, well, I'm going to release it into the sky, you know? And he was like, oh, what are you gonna do? You're going to release this bird and she will go and make love with other birds and then come back to my birds and give them disease. And I was like, what? I couldn't believe. No, that's not what I want. And I'll just take one. And he's like, no, 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 no. Fine. I'll just go to this next guy. Meanwhile, that first guy was talking to the other guy in French and saying, no, don't sell to this American. So now this guy's like, no. And I went to the next guy, and it happened like that. It was like five people would not sell me anything, and they were laughing at me. One guy tried to sell me like a big skunk. They were mocking me, and I got so upset that I literally ran away from the bird market. Completely dejected. I'd given up on it. It was devastating. I just decided I'm just going to walk around aimlessly. And a week later, I went to go see the windmill at the Moulin Rouge. I had wanted to see it. And I see in the netting of the Moulin Rouge, right below the windmill of the Moulin Rouge, that famous windmill, there's this green netting, and it's to keep pigeons out of there. Trapped in the green netting is this big male pigeon. It was hanging downwards with its wings extended, almost like the way I can describe it is like an upside down Jesus, like a cross shape. I thought, oh my God, this is it. I knew what it was at that moment. And then I saw a white door and a buzzer that was the backstage to the Moulin Rouge, so I started pressing the buzzer. A guy came out, it was a very cute Frenchman. And he looked at the bird and he looked at me and he said, ah, I will make the rescue. He came back with a tall ladder, the tallest ladder I've ever seen. And I was afraid that he was going to cut the bird down and just let it go. So I started to climb up the ladder after him. And he turned back to me and he was like, no, stop. He cut the bird down. He was holding the bird in his gloved hand. And he came and he handed me the bird. I was taking the Holy Grail out of somebody's hand. This is what I had come to Paris for. This is why I was here. I felt at that moment something release in me to let go of some of that grief. I know that was Poppy communicating with me. I mean, I don't know that, but I felt that. But I had almost constant pain and grief over the hurricane birds. Still, it took many, many years for me to not actually feel like that all the time. In a weird way, I think that Poppy and I still communicate through birds. I have saved many pigeons in New York City since then.
But wait, dear listener, wait. Nikki's story goes on from this point. She wrote a book about it, The Bird Market of Paris. Discover it on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Anna Sussman, with sound design by Renzo Gorio. How do you know what you know when you don't know how you know it? Snap Judgment, the Omen episode, will be right back with a story from the future. For real, stay tuned. Now, you know that trips to the post office are never convenient. So get official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk at stamps.com. Use your own computer and printer. Stamps.com even gives you special postage discounts you just can't get at the post office. Never pay full price for postage again. Stamps.com. And right now, use our name, SNAP, for this special offer. A no-risk trial plus a $110 bonus offer, including $55 in free postage. Go to stamps.com. Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and enter SNAP. Stamps.com. Enter SNAP and happy mailing.
Thanks for listening to SNAP. Don't forget to download Latino USA. It's the podcast all about how Latinos are living, shaping, and changing America. Find Latino USA now at iTunes.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Snap Judgment, storytelling with the beat, the Omen episode. Snappers, my name is Lim Washington, and I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. Close your eyes and imagine, pretend that it was your job to see into the future. Now, what if you couldn't do that anymore? Keep those eyes closed unless you're driving or juggling babies. Snap Judgment.
Futurology Inc., please hold.
It's my 657th day at Futurology Inc. It's the future. It's been the future for a while. Today I'll sit in my cubicle and stare at my computer as some arbitrary neuron far in the recesses of my gray matter triggers visions upon visions. It's like going down a sucking spiral, ears plugged up, feeling like a big pillow stuffed over my face. Then finally, that humdrum future moment.
A
perfectly round, packed snowball, whizzing right through an open window. It'll happen the morning of the last snow, 2 winters from now. A daughter will giggle, her hand frozen and red.
Get over here.
Her mother will yell through the shattered glass. Tomorrow, an elderly man will miss his bus because he's too busy with the morning crossword. The word he won't be able to find is amygdala.
So the earthquake is going to hit LA on Monday the 13th, not on Tuesday.
Okay, daytime, evening?
I don't have a read on that yet, but I'll let CHP know as soon as I do, and then they can schedule the freeway shutdown.
Cool, and next royal baby, boy or girl?
Oh, the 1 3 years from now? That's a girl.
I don't see any of those things. At least I haven't for a while. Instead, another flash. A rush to the head. I see a younger man waking up alone, staring at the indent on the pillow next to him. He'll pick up a long, stray brown hair. He'll press his face into the down puff, and he'll smell her. Fresh grass, orange pith, and starched, mothy linen. I need coffee.
Hey, man, how are those cancer cures coming along?
I see a man, not young, not old. He's wearing a brown corduroy jacket. He walks out of an office building holding an electric blue box. Is that from our copy room? Huh. He pulls his red cap over his ears and slips into the sidewalk traffic. A bird swoops, fast, from overhead, nearly hits him. The man ducks, then looks up. The bird's gone, but it doesn't matter. The man's looking at the sun as it breaks through the overhanging bruise-colored clouds. He closes his eyes and feels warmth on his face.
You seem fried today. You need to go home or something?
Oh, do I? I guess I just need some coffee, probably. I don't know.
Cool. See you at the staff meeting.
Damn, I forgot I lied about the cancer cures. I'm still waiting for the big, important visions to come back. Instead, my head plays a slideshow of worthless happenings, day in, day out. A blonde woman buys an expensive, long black skirt to impress her mother-in-law. A woman with gray hair runs the faucet and looks blankly out the window. A teenage boy hits a squirrel with his new bicycle on the way home sometime next month, its spine bent under the wheel. A woman cuts off the anklet she's worn for 4 years without a thought. A fruit fly lands on a lemon, stumbles into a divot on its gold rind.
Hey, do you have a minute to talk about the cancer cures?
Oh, hey, didn't see you, sorry.
What are you working on exactly?
Insect population futures?
I didn't know that was something we did here.
In a month, this man will fire me. I saw it a week ago. Not like I needed a prediction to tell me this would happen. I didn't see the whole scene. Just my stress ball tearing open as I squeezed it. The tiny spheres spilling across the floor, pink, plastic.
We'll see you at the staff meeting. 20 minutes, okay? Conference room B.
Yeah, sure. Okay, thanks. I find one of the electric blue paper boxes in the copy room. I dump the reams onto the floor and take the empty box to my desk. I don't have much to pack up. No papers, no pictures. I pull on my brown corduroy jacket, pick up the box, and leave this place for the last time. It's cold. I pull my red cap over my ears, slip into the sidewalk traffic. so I never see anything that matters, at least nothing of consequence to Futurology, Inc. But these visions, these moments I've been seeing, not big, but still important somehow, little bits of the in-between, faces and places and sadness and joy and beginnings and endings. And then a bird swoops fast from overhead, nearly hits me. I duck, then look up. The bird's gone, but those clouds, gray, full, almost bruise-colored. The sun breaks through. I close my eyes. This light, this warmth. Men and women pass by, hunched and cold, looking at their feet as they hurry to the next thing, and the next, and the next. I'll stand here just a little longer. I don't want this moment to end. At least, not yet. Not until I see another.
Now, Snappers, let's all take a moment just to be in the moment. You can read more of Christine Steinbeek's work on our website, snapjudgment.org. That story is produced by Eliza Smith, with sound design by Leon Morimoto. Yes, it's that time, Snappers. We're about to release you from the clutches of Snap's underground studios here in Oakland, California. But know this, if you've got to have your fix, hours of Snap Judgment storytelling await, free for the asking. Subscribe to the podcast while you still can. We don't know how long we can hold off the forces of evil. Snapjudgment.org. Find movies, pictures, stuff, subscribe. I'll wait. No, I'm not going to wait. Snap Judgment. Snap was produced by myself and a group of people that take omens seriously. Say hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. Pat Massimi Miller, Anna, the warrior Sussman, the dreamer, Joe Rosenberg, Julia Can-Do DeWitt, Wenzel Can't Go Goryeo, Davey Kim rides a unicycle, Nancy Lopez takes grown people's transportation, the mystical, magical, mystery tour operators, Anna Adlerstein, Eliza Smith, Leon Morimoto, and Aurora Soria. Additional funk provided by Jasmine Aguilera. Now, did you ever have an omen that bad news and evil tidings might befall the country unless Snap Judgment start calling the shots? Well, if you do, call the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Let them know. We need thanks to the CPB. PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, will gladly exchange your public radio for three magic beans. Take them up on it. PRX.org. WBEZ in Chicago doesn't feel the cold. And this, of course, is not the news. No way is this the news. In fact, you could have a vision of a dark and stormy night. Run to tell the neighbors, get picked up by the police for trespassing, get beaten with sticks, and kicked repeatedly in the head and in the face, only to have them realize, hey, this isn't a black guy, our bad. And you would still, I'd be as far away from the news as this is, but this is NPR.